This is Scott Allen from odecode.com.
This is Kevin Dente.
This is John Galloway.
This is Scott Coon from lazycoder.com.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to Herding Code. Today we're going to talk about interviewing and hiring your fellow developers. So, does anybody actually like hiring? What do you guys think? Is it a process that you just detest, or is it something that you actually enjoy?
I actually enjoy the interviewing process. I enjoy talking to people, but my track record has shown that I do not do a very good job actually making a hiring decision. So I try to avoid it now, for fear of destroying a company.
I kind of like the meeting people part of it, but I think it's kind of hard because I like people, but I, depending on the job, it's a small percentage of the people you interview that you really want to hire. So it's just kind of a hard conversation, I think. You know, you have to be all smiley, and halfway or a quarter of the way through the interview, a lot of the time you're like, yeah, this is kind of a waste of everyone's time.
I like the talking to people part. If we're talking about being the interviewer instead of the interviewee. So I kind of like, you know, I like seeing the diversity of background and see, you know, kind of things that they've done that I haven't ever done before and ask them about that or see how they'd approach a problem. But I hate the judgmental part. I hate having to sit in judgment of a 30-minute or even in a two-hour interview and assess, you know, somebody's skill in a completely false situation. Or, you know, worst of all, trying to decide if they're going to fit in well with the team. Because in my view, skill is, you know, it's something that can be taught, it's something that can be learned, but being a team player, so to speak, or being able to not go all cowboy coder halfway through a project or at the beginning is more important, I think, than kind of the tangible things, like can you write a bubble sort from scratch, or can you, you know, do you know how to cast a variable to another variable and what the downfalls or possible, you know, pitfalls are.
Well, I think
that's the hardest part. Generally, you only spend a limited amount of time with them, and, you know, even calling references, that to me has been particularly a waste of time.
Yeah, with today's legal setup, you know, all you're going to get out of most places is, yes, they worked here from that date to that date. And they're not going to open themselves up for any kind of litigation to anything else. So calling a reference, you know, you might as well call their mom and ask them if they're a good person.
I think the only kind of reference that really carries a lot of weight is personal recommendation. I was thinking back on most of my jobs, programming jobs, and I'm thinking all but my first job I got through, I knew somebody, you know, and I'd worked with them before or knew them or some, you know, so it's, I think that if you have to call someone's references, you've already kind of lost because you don't know the person and you're hoping that you're going to get a clue about them from somebody that third hand, as opposed to you really know them. And I mean, the ideal is going to be, you already know that they're the right fit.
Well, and through the personal recommendations, the second half is not only is this person going to be a good fit for the company, but is the company going to be a good fit for this person? So when someone says, hey, you know, here's this place I work at is great, you should come try and work here, you get a better sense of whether or not you would enjoy working there or whether or not it's just going to be a trudge through, you know, several, you know, circle of Dante's Inferno. So the big question that I've always had is, why are interviews for programming jobs so much different than other kind of professional jobs? I kind of made the point that, you know, my wife has to be licensed and certified and has to, you know, in order to keep her license up, she has to take continuing education credits to prove that she just isn't, you know, sitting back on 10-year-old knowledge. Whereas with, you know, software development, you know, the first thing they're asking is, you know, are you an idiot kind of, you know, things, or, you know, asking programming questions from CS 101 or from CS 707 or worse, you know, depending on what level you think you're going for. And so I'm kind of trying to ascertain some better way of interviewing programmers and determining whether or not they're competent or whether or not they, you know, whether or not they're basically lying on their resume is what most interviews are for programmers. You know, so you go through there, you pick out what was interesting about this project, and you try to find out if it was just some school project that they worked on, or if they're inflating their role on the project to make them sound more impressive, themselves sound more impressive. So how do you get around asking things like, how do you write a bubble sort, or how do you, did you really work on that project, or, you know, are you just lying?
Well,
FizzBuzz, does anyone ever ask the FizzBuzz question?
Hell no. Most of my programming questions I take straight from whatever project I'm currently working on, because I'm just not smart enough to have a backlog of clever little tricks and programming, you know, factoids that I should pull out. So I look at things that I've either solved or I'm trying to solve, and I posit those to the interviewee, and I say, okay, so here's what we're doing. We have this legacy database, blah, blah, blah. We have to implement this functionality. How would you go about doing it? And, you know, see what they're doing. And a lot of times, you know, if I end up using their solution, well, we hire them.
I think things like a bubble sort or whatever, where that's a Google search, you know, if you don't know how to do it, those are a waste of time. But I do ask questions about what did you do on how did this project work, because I try and get people to get into specifics that they're excited about and remember. So, you know, it's like if somebody wrote something that managed a message management system, then I go, well, how'd you deal with this? Well, how'd you deal with failed messages? Well, you know, and try and get them to kind of light up and go, oh yeah, that was hard. You know, we first tried this and that didn't work, and so we did this. And you know, I want to hear that, like, number one, they get excited about things, that they solve problems, and then I forget what number two was.
Sorry, John, that's a no hire for me.
Ouch.
Can't even remember his own questions.
So I was talking to Jeffrey Palermo at an event. One of the events is here, an interesting story about his interview process, which is basically you bring a developer in and they're there for a full 8 hours and they do pair programming with the rest of the team. And I thought that was a really, really kind of interesting way. It's a long interview for that person, but I think that's worthwhile.
Yeah, that's a really interesting approach, because that also helps figure out whether they would be a good fit for the team, sort of personality-wise. You'd get a much better sense of that actually working with somebody. So what about interview questions? We've mentioned that a couple of times already. We've all read about, you know, the FizzBuzz approach. We've read about the Hanselman interview trivia quiz. You know, there's the puzzle type questions that are sort of, you know, legendary for a place like Microsoft, where they ask you to estimate how long it takes to move Mount Everest or whatever. What do you guys think about those different approaches, and do you use any of those, or do any of those, you know, work for you guys when you're doing interviewing?
I always dislike getting into, you know, situations, and I've had this happen a couple of times where I've had to argue with the interviewer because they were wrong. And, you know, it's they'll ask some kind of trivia question, and then I'll say, well, you can also do this, and say, no, that doesn't work. And I'm like, yeah, it really, that does. And, you know, you're never in a situation where you can just pull out the compiler and let the compiler solve, you know, answer the question for you and say, let's try it and see. And so then you get in this situation where, you know, so do I just suck it up and just let this guy be wrong and agree with him? Or, you know, do I prove my point and maybe not get the job? But I don't like asking stuff like that. And I had to deal with this a lot because I was at a physical science major. It was biochem. So we'd study, and instead of studying the how things work, we were more in the what are the parts, what are the individual pieces. So we'd have to, like, I remember this one question in particular was, it was something about what is the hydrophobicity of DNA. And the point of the question was to prove that when you're doing experiments on DNA, the environment you're in is actually much more like, you know, an oil drop than it is a beaker of water. But the question was just something you could Google or look up very simply. And so that's always kind of stuck with me, and I've always avoided those kinds of, you know, factoid questions where you just have to, it's a Google search away if you can get the right keyword. And I've always, you know, and I kind of hate to kind of channel the Microsoft way of interviewing, because I think they've mostly stopped doing the, you know, how do you determine which one of the light bulbs or lights is turned off, or which light bulb the switch controls kind of questions. And they've stuck to more, how would you implement this? And you can kind of see how it relates to whatever technology you're interviewing for. But I like to see kind of how people are thinking, but I don't know that I don't know that any of the questions I'm asking are really going to show how they're going to, you know, really think under in a real world situation. And I don't think that you can get a real world situation in any kind of interview, because they're going to be on the best behavior. They're going to be nervous. You know, God forbid they've been sitting there for 8 hours with a bunch of people they don't know, having to program in front of them. You know, for one thing, it takes members of your team away for that day. So you have to try and schedule it during downtime or something. But secondly, so, you know, you're stuck there with these people. And if in the first 2 hours you know that it's not the kind of place you want to work, then, you know, you got 6 hours of sitting around with people maybe you don't like.
Well, you know, I think when it comes to questions, that as an interviewer, I should be working harder than the interviewee. So, you know, I think of it like, say, I'm the analyst, and it's my job to diagnose and to find out where this person's coming from and who they are. And if, like, I can fail the interview more than they can, you know, if I'm not pulling the best out of them. And so, like, I think that the three kind of things I want to do when I'm talking to them, like, number one, first get an idea of what they know, like, at a very high level. But afterwards, I should be able to say, like, this guy knows databases, and he's kind of weak on this, but he could figure it out, you know? So, like, just a rough assessment of where people are at. And not trivia in that it's pass-fail, but just kind of, just say, like, you know, how would you do how would you back up a database? What, you know, what's a primary key? And that, I mean, and, you know, I'll apologize if they're elementary questions and the person's reacting that way, but I'll just be like, I'm trying to just kind of roughly fit you in where we're at. But then once I have an idea what they know, then I'll try and ask a question that they're not going to be able to answer. And the idea there is not to screw with them, but to see what they do when they don't know, because that's what programming's about. You're working most of the problems, you know, hopefully you're not doing stuff you know all day long. That's kind of drudgery. I mean, I as I'm working, I hit a wall, and then I figure out how to get past it, and then I hit another wall, and, you know, I work through my problems. And so I want to kind of hit people with something and see, like, do they fall apart or what, and then say, well, what would you do, you know? And if they say, well, I go buy a book, or I hit MSDN, or I Google it, or here's where I'd look. I mean, those are all, like, important things. And then the last thing I want to do is just see if they have passion. So it's kind of like, well, you know, like a huge bonus point thing for me is if people have contributed to open source projects, just because it shows they are going to continue to learn and continue to grow as developers, as opposed to, you know, they do their job and go home. So I think the important thing with all that is, like, asking questions for a reason and trying to get somewhere, and not just kind of like lob trivia questions at people until they break or make you happy.
So one of the things that I'm kind of wondering here is, if we aren't really testing people's ability to pass an interview when we interview, I mean, the whole process, you know, is so outside of the normal day-to-day drudgery of work that, you know, we're really seeing is how well do these people interview, much in the same way that a lot of the standardized tests just teach you, you know, test your ability to take a test and not necessarily the information contained within. And so I'm wondering, you know, if we get on the path of, you know, trying to figure out how people think, then, you know, we're forcing them to kind of guess, well, okay, so how do they want me to think? How can I, you know, how can I pass this?
I know where you guys are coming from on the interview question thing, but I do feel like, at least from I sort of use some of these kinds of, you know, some might call them trivia, but, you know, detail questions as a sort of a pre-screening. Often I'll you know, actually email them to somebody, you know, a few things that sort of anybody who has any sort of depth of knowledge in the .NET framework, for example, would know. And if they, and I ask them to, you know, write up an answer or just an email. And if they can't do that, they can't write up a decent answer. And if they can't Google the answer, because it's not like they have to, you know, provide the answer right there, they have time to go Google it, then that's kind of telling to me right there.
So I agree, kind of questions are not going to get you very far. And I've had people, I've I've interviewed a lot of people, and I've hired people that just were great at answering questions and then just did nothing when they were on the team. They just did not produce. And, you know, I mean, that's really what it all comes down to. And the way they do interviews at Vertigo, I really kind of like they have two sections. There's a practical, you know, they give you a problem that you look at it and you go, this is really pretty easy. Like they gave me the thing, they showed it to me and they said, okay, write it in any language, do it, you know, just show us it's got to do this, this, and this. And I said, so what's hard about that? And they're like, well, a lot of people have trouble with it. And I totally, like, I did very poorly on it. I didn't finish the application. Parts of what I finished did not work. I mean, it was really pretty bad. And so then they said, okay, now we'll bring it in. I showed it on a projector, and I got to talk through it, and we did kind of like a code review. And they said, well, what about this? You know, should that have any kind of exception management? And I said, yeah. And then they said, well, what would you do? And then I talked about how you'd manage exceptions. And so then what I thought was good about it was, like, we had an interview, but it wasn't around their trivia. It was around code I'd written. And I got to say, like, here's what's wrong with my code. Here's what I would have done better. Here's what I'm proud of, though. Check this part out. And we went off on some tangents afterwards. But for me, I felt like they got to see that they got to see that I don't crank code out very quickly, but that I kind of knew what I was talking about, and that what I would do next given time. So I thought that was helpful, as opposed to, like I was saying, guys that I've done verbal interviews with and they did well on the questions and they proved that they're good interviewees, but they didn't actually write any code when the time came.
And one of my coworkers likes to, or former coworkers, likes to give a very basic little design test, which is, it's not even writing code really. It's just sort of like design an object model, and it's a really basic, you know, design an object model for a drawing program, right? Which is like the just object oriented 101, and it's shocking how many people can't do that, like can't. Have, you know, just can't come up with just basic object oriented concepts. And you could argue that those people should never have gotten into the interview in the first place, which is kind of a different issue. But actually seeing people, how people think about that kind of stuff, and I actually think is kind of important, because, you know, they can fire trivia answers at you, or they can talk about their projects, but actually seeing their thought process is incredibly valuable, I think.
Oh, so I'd kind of discussed certs, certifications, and licensing. So there's a big difference between certified. Yeah, certs as they are worthless. Well, they're not necessarily worthless. They show that someone knows how to pay money, and that they're able to get through one of the cert boot camps. And, you know, that's something. Sitting through that and having, you know, they're good at rote memorization. But there's a big difference between certifying and licensing. Licensing, you cannot legally practice the profession if you do not have a license, and it requires one. So, like, you can't just go and say, hey, I'm a doctor now, or I'm a pharmacist, or I'm an electrician. But you can say, I'm a software developer, because I wrote that one Access database. And you could have an Access cert, an Oracle cert, to back up the fact that you're a software developer, but, you know, it doesn't really mean that you are. And so I know there's lots of people that are working hard to, you know, maintain the integrity of some of the certs. I know a couple of guys who fly up once or twice a year to work on the questions for, like, SQL Server exams for MS certification. And, you know, and they're trying to put in real world, you know, questions, real world situations, not just, you know, how do you use this new feature that was touted in the marketing literature in SQL Server 2000, you know, 9.5. So how can we make either certifications more worthwhile, or is it worth trying to create some kind of a license, or is there some other way that we can skip kind of the, you know, does this person know what they're talking about? you know, kinds of things. I mean, sometimes, you know, having weblogs, having books published will help. Like, you wouldn't, if you were interviewing Don Box for whatever, you know, rationalized reason, you wouldn't say, well, Don, you know, how would, you know, what does I unknown mean to you?
It was a lifestyle. Yeah, but the certification question is pretty tough. I think, because I've been involved in the process a little bit, and I had this personal goal at one time to try to make it better. But the problem is, to make certification scalable, you have to pretty much come up with a multiple choice question that gets distributed and run on computers, as opposed to something like the Microsoft Certified Architect Program, I forget the exact name of it, that's actually a series of interviews with people and projects, but you know that thing costs like $10,000. The certifications, the biggest problem is that the industry's so young, and to come up with these certifications, you have to make every question a clear-cut question where there's only one right answer, and every other answer is undeniably wrong. Because the problem that companies and vendors fear the most is that someone will take a certification exam to court and say, all right, I had this question about SQL Server, and apparently the correct answer was to use a clustered index, but I can prove in this question that I could do the same thing with a composite covering index, blah, 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 you know, some strange technical detail. At which point the court could say, you know, let's throw the certification out. Certification's no good. And then everybody loses. The company that makes the certification loses. The people that got certified loses. And I'd really like to see something happen in the software industry where you can ratchet this up to the level of something like a license or, you know, something where someone gets a certification and it actually means something. It means they should be working in this field. But the problem is, as soon as you make the certification that important, then as soon as someone's livelihood depends on them passing a certification, then the legal stakes get even higher and the questions have to be scrutinized even further. And it's just very, very, very hard to write a question about a technology and word it in a way so that there's only one correct answer. And, you know, there's some that's okay. You know, you're asking a question about a master page or asking a question about garbage collection or some little piece of minutia about the CLR. But, and even those questions can be tough. But if you try to take a step back and try to judge a person, you know, based on maybe some design principles. So try to present a question where they can pick dependency injection versus this versus that. And those questions are just almost impossible to say. Here's the one correct answer and the three that are provably false.
Right. I mean, I was going to say a very similar thing. I was looking at Scott's post, and the first comment was saying that SWEBOK, SWEBOK, Software Engineering Body of Knowledge, is an effort to come up with a standardized body of knowledge. The problem is, as I went through and looked at the links, and I was like, man, I wouldn't hire anybody that worked this way, you know? And so I think that it's very, like, that body of knowledge that they're defining is very much the, like, industrial, large, you know, you're working in a huge development shop and we're working with Waterfall. Like, it actually kind of assumed Waterfall. And mm-hmm. and so I totally agree. I think that there are so many different methodologies, so many different ways of building software, whereas like if you there's pretty much set practices for how a plumber should work, and there's code for how an electrician should work, and even exactly. When you get, I mean, there's difference of opinion, I'm sure, in the medical profession, but there's accepted ways of doing things, whereas you get into the software engineering world and it's like the only real, I mean, the two things that are going to define success is, like, number one, can a team all work together and do it that way? And number two, does the software ship and work, you know? And so, like, you can build working software with drag and drop controls, but that's not going to cut it in some shops. Like, you could be great at that and you could have a great record at building software that way, but if you go to a shop that's heavy into agile and test-driven development, you're not a good fit there. and your past record doesn't really say that necessarily you're going to be, or, and vice versa, you know. So somebody that comes in from a huge code-first methodology is not necessarily going to fit in as well at a shop that's very into tools and
waterfall,
yeah,
stuff like that. Yeah, absolutely. And that's why so many of these certifications, then they start focusing on the only thing that is consistent among all those different methodologies, which is the API. So you need X to appear on the screen. What do you pass to the foo method? A, B, C, or D,
right?
Which is not a great thing to test on. It's something you can memorize, but it's the only area that's not gray.
It's the lowest common denominator. I agree on that. That really, if you're down to testing bubble sorts or how many bits are in this data type in SQL Server or that kind of thing, it's you've kind of lost at that point. Like, you're not really going to get an idea anything more than is this person able to memorize trivia. Kevin, can you talk about, like, you work at a bigger company? What's the hiring process like there, and or can you talk about that?
Well, it has varied over the years. Certainly, we try to go through referrals, people that we know, as much as possible, but that is not as doesn't happen as often as we would like. So we've had to work with recruiters, and that process is very difficult. I don't know if you guys have had much, you know, spent much time working with recruiters to try to find people, but
yeah,
I'm not a fan of that approach. You end up having to filter through a lot of crap. Because, you know, recruiter is paid on whether you hire them. And so what's important to them is that you hire them, not that you hire the right person in a lot of cases. So it's you know, I find hiring to be absolutely one of the most difficult things about working. It's can be incredibly time consuming. You know, you spend a lot of time trying to find the right candidate, and every time you give that hire decision, you're taking a risk that, you know, you've had the wool pulled over your eyes. So it's tough.
I think that I've worked at companies before where they just had huge groups of consultants. They just hired hourly consultants, and people would stay there for 5 years or more as an hourly consultant. And that really bugged me from a team building point of view, from so many different, just the inefficiency from a financial point of view. And I know that they do it so they can control what's in their operating budget and all that. But I think also part of why they do that is so that they can always just say, like, hey, you're done, you know, like, really, they could, you're an hourly worker at that point. So they could just say, like, okay, thank you for the past 3 years, but don't come in next Monday. And I know that you can do that. You can fire people depending on the laws, the state you're in. But I know in California, you can pretty much drop somebody whenever. But there's kind of an understanding that you're not going to fire somebody just because you're tired of them. Like, you really kind of have to cross a line. Whereas if it's an hourly consultant, it's just like, yeah, okay, I didn't like your last few hours, you're gone. You know.
The contractor angle is even more interesting in Washington, because Microsoft used to employ what they kind of, they didn't term them this, but they kind of ended up being perma-temps. So you would end up with these contractors that were there for, you know, years and years and were part of the team. And then at some point, some of them contractors got a little uppity and they sued for benefits. They figured since they were being treated as members, you know, as employees, that they deserved some of the benefits. Probably, given the time, I think it was the mid to early 90s, probably they were looking for options. That's pure speculation on my part, though. And so they enacted this law where, I think, yeah, it's a law that contractors in Washington can't work more than, is it 9 months for a single employer? Then they have to take 3 months off. They can work somewhere else as a contractor. Like, so they could bounce back and forth, I guess, between Microsoft and Google, do 9 month stints, but they can't work a full year somewhere. I don't know what that has to do with anything John just said, but I thought it was kind of cool.
No, I think that is really, I know from a hiring point of view, having to look at some of the legalities of what people could do as far as leaving a permanent position and becoming a contractor, and what the rules were to make sure that that was above board. And that was really tricky.
Which you end up with is you have these people, contractors, that take 3-month vacations, and they come right back to the position they were in before. So, you know, they work 9, and then, hey, they get to go travel, get to go do whatever, 3 months. And they come back, and they're right in the same spot, right where they were before.
Kind of like being an academic. But that lawsuit affected California workers, too. I mean, my wife is an independent contractor, and companies now are very careful about, you know, making sure that if they hire you as a contractor, they treat you as a contractor. They don't park you in an office in their building and, you know, tell you exactly what to do and you know, treat you as if you were an employee, except that you're hourly. And it was all because of that Microsoft lawsuit.
I guess the company that I worked at before where they did that, they went through a staffing agency. So the staffing agency placed people there, but you did fill out an hourly timesheet and all that, but it was okay because it was through the staffing agency that you were placed there. But it does get really odd. And then, of course, I don't know if you guys have, but I've run into several things where the staffing agency happens to be owned by the CTO or some ridiculous thing like that. I've been surprised at how bad some of that is at some larger companies.
Oh yeah, that kind of, it's not necessarily nepotism, but you know, even nepotism in companies runs rampant. You know, how many times have you had to fix an app written by, you know, some director, CEO, CTO's nephew, grandson, son, you know, whatever. More often than not, not necessarily more often than not, but a few times, enough to make it noticeable. And you know, it's kind of the same idea. In the past, companies I've worked for have hired contractors sight unseen because some director used to work with them or something else, which, you know, it's a fine line between personal reference and getting kickbacks. But I think, yeah, what you're mentioning there is more of a kickback or, you know, something along those lines.
So have you guys found yourself in the position where you said, yeah, you know, yes on a hire, and then 2 weeks or a month after working with this person, you're like, oh, crap, what have we done? We really blew it.
Yeah, I definitely have, and I alluded to this a little bit before, but I worked at a company before where there was kind of a group of hotshots that were all kind of the boss's golden children. So me and a few other guys decided we were all going to get certified so that we could kind of call their bluff a little bit. Anyhow, so my friends and I all got certified at this company. It was me and 3 other guys, and then we needed to hire some people, and somebody came in for the hire, and we were all pumped full of all these questions from our MCSD. Well, this guy had just been studying for his MCSD, and he aced all our questions. And we're like, this guy's awesome, man. I thought that stuff was tough. This guy's a genius. And then we sat him down at a desk, and literally, I mean, we reassigned him to different projects. We had all this stuff. At the end, you know, I was doing the Lumberg thing where I'm stopping by his desk. Hey, Peter, how you doing? And nothing was happening. Like, I never got any code out of the guy, you know? And so, I mean, that was definitely a spot where I was like, I'm not going to go off of answering trivia again. Like, I've got to pull out more from them than just can they answer a lot of questions. Because I totally got fooled on that one.
I've been fooled like that too, and it was really amazing the first time it happened to me. I couldn't believe that this guy answered so many questions correctly during an interview process. And when he sat down at the computer, he could do absolutely nothing. Could not operate the IDE, could not build a project to save his life. And then I've also been in the situation where I've said yes to a hire who kind of worked out pretty well for the first couple weeks, and then all of a sudden he was missing on a Monday, and then the next week he was missing on Tuesday and missing on Thursday afternoon. And you know, after a couple months, the guy is barely showing up to work. You know, different situation. I don't know how you catch those kind of things, but it's kind of funny because we were actually sitting at a luncheon discussing if we should fire this guy or not, when all of a sudden he calls and says, yeah, my wife just locked the keys in her car. I have to go home for the day. And we said, okay, it's time.
So I've been in that situation, not so much from a programming skill or ability perspective, but from a team fit perspective. Sometimes, you know, you hire somebody based on their technical ability, and in this particular case didn't give sufficient weight to the ability to fit in with the team and sort of personality and that sort of thing. And that's a really, really tough one, because I think in that case it's probably even harder to fire somebody, because you can't just say, they can't do the job. You know, their code is terrible. They can't write code to save their life. In that case, it's a more subtle thing where, like, they're just not gelling with the team. And it's a tricky situation to extricate yourself from.
Does anyone ask any of the, I think they call them behavioral interview questions, the questions like, tell me about a time when you were faced with a stressful situation?
How about this? The question where you're walking through a desert and you see a turtle lying on its back, and it's lying on its back, but you don't help it, and it's big. No, Blade Runner, anyone? Never. You're all replicants. Coming for you.
Just I've heard Chris Sells say that he asked what he calls them behavioral interview questions, and they work really well for him. But I've always felt like I don't know. I don't get anything from them as an interviewer.
I'm just curious I don't know exactly what you mean by behavioral questions.
They're questions like, they usually start off with tell me. So like, tell me about a time when you were able to persuade someone to see things your way. Or tell me about a time you set a goal and you met it. Or tell me about a time when you set a goal and you weren't able to make that goal. What did you do about it? Just very soft questions, you know, that when I ask them, all I keep thinking is, this person's just going to BS his way through this. But I've talked to a couple people who say they're effective in determining the mindset and how the person will fit into the team. You know, tell me about a time when you failed. Tell me about a time when you took some initiative and drove a project to its conclusion.
Yeah.
So really, tell me.
Nothing comes to mind.
See? I had to deliver a computer to a customer once, and that was pretty much me driving it to its conclusion.
Yes. I think, too, there's nothing. I mean, it's pretty hard to spot, like, not just intentional BS, but somebody really may have thought that they drove a project to its conclusion, and yet the project was a total failure. So, kind of hard to know.
I mean, sometimes I haven't tried it much, but I think you might be able to find someone who just has a really negative attitude, who just likes to, if you're asking these kind of questions and someone's blaming everything, all of their problems on other team members or on the company, you know, that would sort of be a red flag. But
right.
I think most people are kind of smart enough to try to BS it.
So we've been talking about being on the interviewer side, not so much on the interviewee side, although John touched on it a little bit. But I'm just wondering if anything sticks out in your guys' minds as, like, particularly good interviews or interviews where you've walked away and felt like you really, you know, that it wasn't a horribly painful experience, but that, you know, you really got to communicate what you wanted to communicate in the interview, and what sort of, you know, was it enabled that to be a really good interview?
Yeah, I had this interview back in the .com boom days where I wanted to join a company that was going to sell real estate mortgages over the web. And I was interviewing with, I forget what the guy's position was, senior engineer, CTO, something. And he wanted to go to a Chinese place for lunch and ask me these questions. I thought, well, yeah, that's perfect. So we're sitting there, and I'm answering all the questions, and the food comes, and I'm still answering questions. And then I realize I'm getting rice on my shirt and soy sauce over here and some of the mustard stuff over here. And I swear to God, by the end of the interview, I looked like, you know, a two-year-old kid who had just been eating with his hands, and there's food all over me and in my hair. But I answered all the questions, but I thought, man, they're not going to take me at this job. I'm a complete slob. But it was memorable. It was fun. And I actually did get hired.
I think the last job where I felt like I crushed it, I didn't get offered the job. And that was several interviews ago. And I found out later, it was a lot of it was due to political stuff where half the people in the interview didn't want me to have the job for specific reasons. Didn't want anyone to have that job for specific reasons. But since then, I think I just generally seem to do worse and worse on interviews. And I think a lot of it's because I'm thinking like the interviewer and I try and outguess things or something. I don't know. But I generally do pretty badly on interviews. So from my doing pretty badly on interviews, background I haven't interviewed a lot, and I guess I've gotten a lot of the jobs, but I always feel like I just fall apart in the interviews. But
I'm with you. I do horrible. I'm a horrible interview. I'm always amazed at how badly I do. Like I don't even remember the simple stuff in an interview. And I'm like, oh my God, how could, you know, I've been doing that for 10 years. How can I not remember DIM?
Right.
You know, or something. There's always something stupid that you forget. And you're like, God, you know, or there's some sort of false situation set up by the interview itself. And you're like, well, you know, I've never done it that way because I know that, you know, these are the problems with doing it that way. And so you just don't know how to do it. And like, oh, crap. Or, you know, or worse, you try to get fancy. And then some tool fails you or something doesn't work right or you forget some crucial step and then everything just kind of, you know, it's like pulling on the loose string on a sweater.
Something about the way you get fancy just happens to be the something that the person interviewing you just hates, you know, or whatever. And you have no way of knowing that. I think I always try and give them enough, like, clues as to what I'm doing and, okay, I don't know that, but here's what I would do. And I've done that before, and when I did that, here's how it worked and stuff. I just forget the specific trivia thing. I guess I have gotten hired for most of, or offers for most of the interviews I've gone to recently. I just have felt like I've done pretty badly as far as answering the questions. Compared to when I interview people, they seem to do a lot better than I do. So, Kevin, you don't get interviewed because you have actual roots growing into your desk.
Yeah, my employment history is unusual in that I've essentially been working for the same company for, I don't know, 15 years or so, with a few weird left turns in there. But
you still have the punch cards from your first program and and from the program you wrote last week.
But I will say that the interview that started it all for me at this company, I was actually interviewing in the QA department. It's when I was still in college. And they asked me why I wanted this job. And this was like a summer gig for me at the time. And my rather flip response was, well, it beats flipping burgers. And that line is apparently what got me the job. Not my technical prowess. All right, that's all the time we have tonight. Thanks for joining us, and I hope you'll join us next week. Well, should we wrap at this point? Okay.
That's our new intro music.
Okay.
And oh, you said those damn birds were turned off.
Oh, I thought you wanted them on.
All right, I'll wait till they finish. Is it 9 chirps?
I posted about a specific solution to a specific problem about a specific router, like wireless router. And that post has become a support forum for all the Netgear router. It's become a support forum for like every kind of Netgear router problem that exists. It's really bizarre. I mean, at least once or twice a week I get a comment on there. Hey, I've got so-and-so router. Can somebody help me fix my problem?
I have one like that, but it's a little more cathartic. The title of the post was just Vizio sucks. And every now and then someone will find it. It's like the number 2 result on Google. And someone will post in there, yeah, it does.
I wrote one thing where it was like, yeah, that's pretty good. I wrote one thing where it was like Gmail, some kind of thing about how to troubleshoot a Gmail connection error. And it was some kind of random thing. And I was just like, here's what I did. And it kind of worked. And I get several comments a week on that. Just which is depressing. You know, I'll write all this other stuff up and people are commenting on my IE batch file and my Gmail, you know, gripe and stuff. And I just get continual, I tried this. Did you try HTTPS? Don't send big attachments. Sometimes that's a problem. You know, all right. You there?
So the red button is not the mute button.
Let me write that down.
It does kind of mute the call for you.
It does. Completely and finally.